This is Vermont Edition, Halloween episode. I'm Jane Lindholm, back from the dead. Just kidding, but I am back from maternity leave, and I'm really happy to be back on the air and with all of you today. Today we are going to embrace the occasion and go full on spooky for Halloween. We'll talk about a graphic novel adaptation of Shirley Jackson's iconic story, The Lottery, which is not so much spooky as deeply troubling. And we'll look at what it takes to run a scary circus with the creator of an experience called Nightmare Vermont. But first, Chittenden's surprising history of seances and spiritualism. I'm joined now in the studio by Jason Smiley. He is a local expert on the Eddy family of Chittenden, Vermont, famous 19th century spiritualists. Jason, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Can you take us back in time and introduce us to these two brothers in particular, Horatio and William Eddy, who were these famous spiritualists, and tell us a little bit about them and the Eddy family?
Sure. So the Eddy family came actually from Clarendon, Vermont, and they moved to Chittenden in the mid-1840s. And they developed a reputation as spirit mediums who could not only speak with the dead, but could actually physically materialize departed loved ones. And initially, they sort of became well known in the mid-1860s. They traveled all over the United States, all over Europe, and they became known for a spirit cabinet routine, which was similar to some other spirit mediums known as the Davenport brothers. And they would go up on stage, and they would go inside this cabinet, and volunteers would tie them up inside the cabinet. And they'd put instruments in there, they'd close the cabinet doors, and suddenly music would be heard, and strange things would come from inside the cabinet. Well, eventually the brothers stopped doing this touring, and they centered their base of operations right in Chittenden in about 1873, and they started having the seances right there at the home. And now people were traveling from all over the world to see these full-bodied physical manifestations of their departed loved ones come out of what they called a cabinet, but it was really more of a closet in an upstairs long hall that they called the circle room.
Huh. Explain a little bit about why people would be coming from so far away to see this, because I imagine today some people may still want to go see some mediums, but I can't imagine people traveling from all over the country for this. This was actually kind of a particular time in American history when this spiritualism movement was really gaining steam.
Yeah, spiritualism really took off in about 1848 near Rochester, New York, with the Fox sisters, who have their own history. And then by the mid-1860s, it really took off because the amount of death that was happening in this country around the time of the Civil War really captured people's attention, and this concept of being able to speak to someone you loved who is now on the other side was pretty attractive. Now, the Eddies were being written about all throughout the United States. They were certainly well written about here in Vermont with the Free Press and the Rutland Herald, but other newspapers started to pick it up, the New York Daily Graphic, the New York Sun, and then before you knew it, they were being talked about everywhere. And people either loved them or hated them. They believed them or they didn't. I like to refer to them as the Kardashians of the time.
Oh, no. And in fact, many of their neighbors were in the camp of people who did not like them.
Correct. Yes, there were several neighbors who didn't care for them at all, didn't even want to talk about them. But what's interesting about that is, when people would come to the Eddy farm, they would pay money to stay there. They didn't pay money for the seances. They paid to spend the night and be fed. Now,
it was like Airbnb, going with cultural references.
Absolutely.
Here,
absolutely. And at that time, there were times the place would be full and the guests would end up needing to stay at neighbors' houses. So the neighbors did benefit a little bit, even though they didn't care for the Eddies. They did have some benefit.
Listeners, if you live in the Chittenden area and you have heard of the Eddy family or maybe have stories that have been handed down in your family, we'd love to hear them. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. Do you have any questions about how mediums and spiritualists were received in the 1800s? You can ask a question of Jason Smiley. Or hey, maybe you are a medium yourself. Tell us about it. Again, 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Okay, so Jason, Horatio and William said they could speak to the dead. And as you mentioned, not just speak to the dead, but embody the dead in some cases and entreat or entice the dead to do things like play musical instruments for the assembled guests?
Yeah, so that's really what made the Eddies unique. There were plenty of spirit mediums at that time, but none that, you know, allegedly had this ability of materializing full-bodied spirits. And they would come out of this cabinet or this closet, and they would come out on stage, and
the brothers would.
Exactly. And there was really only one brother in particular, William. It was a whole family. There were 11 kids total, and 10 of them allegedly had these powers. But oftentimes the family is referred to as the Eddie brothers. And when you hear that, they're really referring to William and Horatio. But only William could do these materializations. And he would go into this cabinet and go into a trance. They would close the blanket over the door. And no sooner would they close the blanket than these spirits would step out of the box. And people who were there, you know, would look up and say, is it for me? Is it for me? To see if it was their loved ones. And what makes it interesting is all of these figures that would come out, you know, they were all different ages, heights, weight, gender, nationality, skin color. Some of them spoke different languages, German, Russian. So people who were attending that day, traveling from all over the world, were hearing their languages spoken by their loved ones.
And they believed they actually saw the vision of this person. So it wasn't just somebody speaking through the brother. It was actually an embodiment of this dead loved one.
Correct. So, you know, someone might come out like a Kurdish warrior dressed in full Kurdish costume with a weapon. So it's hard to imagine, you know, what some people would say these were illiterate, uneducated farmers having, you know, this sort of being able to trick everyone and having hundreds of costumes. But there were a lot of skeptics, a lot of people came to investigate them, wrote articles about them, and a lot of people did come away saying, you know, this is probably one of the brothers just dressed in costume. But it's really hard to kind of disregard all of the, you know, different costumes and so on.
Well, they, you said people investigated, and in fact, at least one newspaper from New York sent somebody to investigate, to live with the Eddies for a week to see if what they were doing was real. And this was a very well-respected investigator at the time. Tell us a little bit about Colonel Olcott, right?
Correct, yeah. Colonel Henry Steele Olcott, he was a Civil War veteran. He later became a lawyer after the war. When President Lincoln was assassinated, he was one of only three people selected to be on the commission to investigate the assassination. So he was a very smart man, very highly respected. And he wrote often for some of the local newspapers in New York. And he took it upon himself to actually go and investigate the Eddies. And he went there for a week in the summer of 1874. And he wrote a letter for the New York Sun, and it became quite a sensation. In fact, such a sensation that a rival newspaper, the New York Daily Graphic, asked Colonel Olcott to go back to Chittenden and spend 12 weeks there and do a full-on investigation. And he did everything. He brought in inventors, architects, construction workers, people to look at the cabinet in the circle room to see if there were trap doors where costumes could be hidden or people who were going to be dressed in those costumes impersonating spirits. And ultimately, after spending 3 months there, he came away thinking that some of the things they did were probably fraudulent, but not the materialization. He felt that was an actual thing they were able to do.
And how was his article or his articles received? I mean, did people buy it, or did they think this guy's been paid off?
It did. It created quite a stir. So he published 20 letters. It came out twice a week for 10 weeks, every Tuesday and Friday in the New York Daily Graphic in the fall of 1874. And there were lots of skeptics and lots of believers. In fact, there was a doctor, a neurosurgeon, Dr. Beard, who came from New York. And he felt that the Eddies were, you know, after reading the Colonel's articles, he said, you know, the Colonel's just being gullible. You know, I'm going to go there and investigate myself. And when he went there, you had to ask the Eddies, by the way, for permission to go. And they actually denied him to come visit. But he came anyway in disguise and in a different name and did a little investigation of his own. He only spent one night there. And he came away feeling that it was all William Eddy, one person going in the box and coming out in all of those different disguises, and said that, you know, he could have duplicated the same feat with, you know, a few cheap costumes. But most of the people who went there, they were there. They were believers. So they came away believers. And all, like I said, you know, these articles were published all over the country, all over the world, and were drawing in people to Chittenden. Chittenden at that time became known as with the nickname Spirit Vale.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Huh. Too bad it hasn't kept that.
Yeah.
Or maybe it has. If you're in Chittenden and it still is Spirit Vale, let us know again. 1-800-639-2211. Jason, what do you think? I mean, you've read all these accounts. Do you think they were fraudsters, or are you a believer?
I get asked that question a lot.
I bet.
And I've been researching the story for about 8 years, and I have to give credit to a couple of people, Greg Gumma and especially Joe Citro. Those are where I sort of got hooked on this story. And, you know, after 8 years of research, I always tell people when they ask me whether I believe or not, I ask them, you know, well, I say it depends on what day of the week you ask me. Asking me today, I would say that they were probably very clever illusionists. But, you know, you're still left with these lingering questions of how did two illiterate, uneducated farmers speak multiple languages, hundreds and hundreds of costumes? The colonel recorded hundreds, like 400 different unique entities in his time there. So, and again, all different genders, heights, weight. It's hard to imagine two brothers and some, you know, other family members pulling that off.
Are you a believer in general that people can communicate with the dead?
Absolutely. Yes. I had an experience with a spirit medium who was dead on, and I'm very, very skeptical. But this person gave me information to my wife, and this isn't, you know, somebody I was connected to on Facebook or anything like that. Nan O'Brien, you may be familiar with her.
Mm-hmm.
She
used to have a radio show.
Yes, and she gave information to my wife from my father to me that my wife didn't even know. So, and it was very specific. It's something no one could have just made up.
How do you think that colors your research of these brothers then and this family?
It makes me want to believe, sort of like that poster on the X-Files. I want to believe.
Uh-huh.
I do. I keep hoping I'm going to find something that makes me a believer. And, you know, unfortunately, I continue to find things that, you know, lean the other way. But, you know, like I said, there's always these lingering questions. And that's what kind of got me started on this story is as I was doing research for a screenplay. And I really wanted to make the story as authentic as possible. And I thought, well, there's got to be information out here in all of these towns and cities that the brothers visited, newspaper articles, you know, what happened from the perspective of the towns. And in researching it, you know, it sort of went down this rabbit hole of digging up more and more information. But I wanted to prove, you know, they alleged that they were actually related to a real witch from the Salem witch trials. Someone who was scheduled to be executed but escaped with the help of friends and family. And I tried to make that connection through genealogy, but have yet to actually find proof of that.
So there's still more to do.
Absolutely. Always.
Let's go to Kim, who's calling in from Chittenden. Hi, Kim. Go right ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to say that two young friends of mine, college students, have written a play called Second Sight, that is about the Eddy brothers, and they will be performing at the Castleton Black Box on December 15th, 16th, and 17th. And I will be playing Helena Blavatsky, who was a Russian aristocrat who came to live with them for a while, and she was a great spiritualist across the world.
Kim, are you a believer?
I don't know. I think there's a lot of information that we do not know about people's powers or talents, but I think it makes a great story, whether you believe it or not.
Well, thank you so much for calling in, Kim, and good luck in the performance. We actually got a note from Ryan, one of those students Kim mentioned, who created the play with Matthew Eckler, and says that it reimagines Henry Steele Olcott and his experiences with spiritualism and the Eddy manifestations. And again, the film or the show will premiere at Castleton University on December 16th. So does that mean these students have beaten you to your plan, Jason Smiley, of writing a screenplay?
Not at all. In fact, I definitely will be there to see that for myself. I'd love to see their play. I've actually communicated with them separately from this. And yeah, my take, you know, a lot of the research I've done has gone very, very deep, things that you wouldn't imagine. It goes beyond sort of the events of 1874 and the colonel. In fact, some people might be surprised. I'm more interested in the intense family drama that was happening behind the scenes of all of this. There was a murder, an assault. assault with intent to kill, a morphine overdose, suicide, kidnapping, incredible drama, incredible story with this family that was all happening on the sides of this whole spirit medium exhibition thing.
Well, speaking of which, you mentioned that in the Eddie family, there were, I think you said 11 children,
yes.
Right? And 10 of them said that they were mediums.
Yep.
So who was the poor sorry kid who didn't have the power?
The firstborn, John Wesley Eddie, we don't know much about him. It's said that he had the temperament of their father, Zephaniah, who did not have any of these gifts. In fact, Zephaniah was very much against these displays of what he considered to be the work of the devil. But he, John Wesley, moved away and really had nothing further to do with the family. They say he went to work for the United States government somewhere down in Panama and died of yellow fever, but I have yet to find proof of that.
Huh. We got a question from Bernie in Rutland who wants to know if you've ever heard about the Eddie House turning on its foundation.
I have. That's one of my favorite stories about the whole Eddie story, the whole Eddie family. Now, the house as you see it today, it's owned by the High Life Ski Club out of New Jersey, and the house is known as the High Life Ski Club Lodge. Now, I have evidence that suggests the house was completely torn down in 1898 and rebuilt. So what you see today, although it looks a little bit similar to how it did in 1874, it's still very different. Maybe the foundation is the same, but I think the whole house is completely different. And when you look at it, what used to be the face of the house isn't there at all. There's just, sort of the long extension part of it that still exists.
So that's where the story of the house turning.
Yeah, there's. I hear this story about a house, just either during a seance or the next day following a seance, people woke up and the house, completely turned. Now, if that actually happened, there would have been something about it in the newspaper somewhere. And I have yet to dig up that nugget, but I love the story. I love it.
And are there still Eddies floating around? I mean, I know Eddies in Vermont. I don't know if they're related, but...
Yeah, there are a few descendants. There were a couple of lines within the Eddie family. Mary Eddie, she married a Huntoon, and there's the Huntoon line, and then also Daniel Webster Eddie, one of the younger brothers. There's descendants on both of those lines, and I've met with some of them and talked with some of them. Some of them enjoy, hearing stories they've never heard from me. They've attended some of the presentations I've done throughout the state. Others are a little more... I hate to use the word, but a bit standoffish. They don't want me to share too much. As an example, I have lots of photographs that family members have asked me not to share, and I absolutely respect that. And, some of the family members that are around still today, they do believe that there was something to this, that their ancestors did have this gift, and they feel, some of them, that they too are intuitive today. So I absolutely respect that. And when I go around the state doing these presentations about the history of the Eddies, I try to make it clear I'm not here to cast judgment on them, because whether you believe that the Eddies were real or not, they have an incredible story.
Well, this is Jason Smiley. He holds that story, working on the screenplay. We're going to look forward to it. Jason, thank you so much for talking with us
today. Thanks
very
much, Shane. I appreciate it.
We've been talking about the Eddie family of Chittenden, Vermont, against famous spiritualists in the 19th century. Coming up, we're going to be opening the pages of a new graphic novel that recreates Shirley Jackson's iconic story, The Lottery, which has a Vermont connection. If you have thoughts on the lottery as a present-day tale, you can call 1-800-639-2211 or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Vermont author Shirley Jackson's story, The Lottery, has worked its way into the public consciousness in a big way. It was first published in the 1940s in The New Yorker and famously led to a flood of horrified letters from readers who thought it was documentary, not fiction. It's the tale of an annual small-town tradition that, spoiler alert, culminates in a public stoning of the unlucky winner of the lottery. Professional illustrator Miles Hyman had considered a graphic novel adaptation of The Lottery for many years. One of the reasons he took the project very seriously was a personal one. He is Shirley Jackson's grandson. His book is out now. It's titled Shirley Jackson's The Lottery, The Authorized Graphic Adaptation. And Miles Hyman joins us today from his home in Paris. Miles, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Well, thank you.
I know it is...
Glad to be here.
It's typically bad form to spoil the plot of a story, but your grandmother's short story is so well known now that I think it seems unfair not to be able to talk about the plot, which, as I said, revolves around a village getting ready for its annual lottery when one member of the community is publicly stoned by the rest of the town. I reread Shirley Jackson's story last night, and was more horrified reading it last night than I was when I originally read it in middle school as a class assignment. This is a really dark tale to be living with and recreating in artistic form, and you've been living with it in some ways your whole life. Why did you want to think about this personally and professionally and recreate it in graphic form?
Well, there are a couple of factors that came into play. It's true that I had just done a couple of mystery stories, adapted a few mystery stories, one of which was James Elroy's The Black Dahlia. And so I felt it was time to take on a project that was a little more personal. My publisher actually suggested this project. As you mentioned, just sort of been sort of playing with the idea over the years. It just felt like a timely project to take on. It had been a daunting one because it's such a difficult story to adapt visually, because it's one long scene, and to adapt it visually, you have to find ways to sort of perpetually renew the way we look at that scene. But anyway, this also being the centenary of Shirley Jackson's birth, it felt like it was the time to take on this huge project.
When you thought about how to do that, you know, how to take this scene in the story and turn it into a visual story through your book, did it affect how you decided to actually make the artwork, you know, what style you were choosing to use and how you depicted those moments from the story?
Yes. In fact, every time I adapt a story, I spend a lot of time reading, rereading the text and really trying to figure out which style, which graphic approach is really going to work with each particular book. And in this case, it felt, it's sort of so close, as you mentioned, to a sort of a documentary way of looking at this event, this fictional event, that it felt like it would be interesting to go at it with a style that was a little bit more realistic than I usually use. Almost as if I was possibly observing these events myself and sort of translating them into drawings. And that seemed to work. The other challenges were choosing between, for instance, black and white and color. And as Jackson very specifically talks about, what a bright, colorful June day this is. It was obviously something that had to be in color, which sort of goes against the grain of the horror of the story and creates a sort of a dissonance in the eye of the reader. The other things that come into play are the use of the architecture, that very sort of austere Shaker New England architecture that enhances the austerity of the scene, and also the light, which is that sort of very abrupt, sharp summer, early summer light that sort of shadows the eyes and makes them hard to read. All of those factors come into play to sort of help me fix a certain graphic approach to adapting any given story.
You know, you mentioned that you did make this in color, and it's beautifully illustrated and really lovely to look
at.
The most vibrant color, I think, is the grass. But, you know, the rest of it almost does have an almost faded photograph look to the artwork. Most of the clothes of the villagers are sort of orange or brown hues, and their faces are, you know, sort of a uniform skin tone that you do get this sense of age, or that you're looking through a looking glass to something that's old in some ways.
Sure, of course, yeah.
Go right ahead.
I was saying there was, it's true, I could have technically adapted the story to any time period. I mean, if there's something about the story that is so timeless, it could have been any time. But the fact that it was such an event in 1948 when it came out and seemed in certain ways to be addressing, I mean, some of the preoccupations of the story are timeless, obviously. But in other ways, I wanted to respect what I think possibly Shirley Jackson was thinking about when she wrote the story, and it was such a time in history that was so fraught with conflict and tension that it seemed appropriate to stick to that period. But my style is it's charcoal drawings. The color is done in Photoshop afterwards, which allows that sort of slightly faded look to predominate, even if there are these sort of shots of color from time to time.
We're talking with Miles Hyman. He's the author and illustrator of the new graphic novel adaptation of his grandmother, Shirley Jackson's story, The Lottery. If you have a question for him or want to share your thoughts on what that story has meant to you, you can call 1-800-639-2211. Michael is calling in from Windsor. Hi, Michael. Go right ahead. You're on the air.
Hello, Jane and Miles. This is Michael from Windsor, and I wanted to say I'm 61 years old, and I can close my eyes, and I can see vividly myself sitting in the auditorium of my high school back in Pennsylvania while the lottery was played out on the stage. And it has been such an instrumental and powerful play or story in my life. I realize that it's taught me about questioning authority and not accepting what I'm told, which sometimes hasn't made me popular in the political world here in Windsor. But it is such a powerful story that I realized affected me so much and still does. And I can close my eyes and see me in that auditorium seat watching it play out. And in the spirit of 6 degrees of separation, I want to thank you to thank your grandmother for creating such a powerful experience for me. So thank you.
Michael, thank you so much for the call.
Thank you.
Yeah, Miles, you must feel this connection to your grandmother through this work. And I'm curious what kind of role she has played in your life. I understand she died when you were just almost 3 years old, so she wasn't a physical presence
right.
in your life, but she seems very powerful.
Oh, yes, she was. Even if, again, as I mentioned in the book, the only memory I have is very sort of vague. However, she did play a huge role throughout my youth and my life, because she had left such a huge influence on family members and on friends and people who were there to sort of nurture and influence me. So she continued to play a role all through my life, and that was, you know, one of the reasons this felt like such a huge undertaking, because it was a way for me to sort of look back and sort of articulate something about how important she had been to me, not only as a young person or later on an adult, but as an artist. And it's true, as Michael mentioned, that I know there's been all sorts of adaptations of this story. One interesting thing about this project is that I live in Paris, and the book came out simultaneously in the United States and in France. And actually, the story is not known here, which is odd because it's so well known in the United States. So I'm sort of the ambassador for my grandmother. I've been presenting the story to French readers who have never read it. And it allows me to sort of really come back and analyze how the story works, why it has had such a huge impact on people. And it's interesting to sort of go at it from that angle as an unknown entity to so many people, and to sort of explain not only the context and why it was such a powerful piece of literature when it came out, but why it's continued to be such an important piece of American literature.
And what's your take? Why do you think it is still so resonant?
You know, I think it speaks to something very sort of raw and very, I would almost say, primal. I think that a lot of the influences that I believe inspired the story go back to something that's very, very sort of deep within us, and talks about things that maybe we aren't comfortable speaking about. the way we tend to battle authority, as Michael said, to follow direction, even though we know perhaps that direction is not correct or not ethical. All of those things are sometimes uncomfortable for people to talk about, and yet very important to discuss. And I think one of the reasons that it works so well in high school and college literature classes is that it provokes us discussion not only about literature but about civics and about all sorts of personal and moral questions.
Let's go to Ken, who's on the line with us from Newfane. Hi, Ken. Welcome to the show.
Good afternoon. Thank you. You know, I grew up in New Hampshire, and for me, Vermont was the promised land. And I arrived. I'm here. Here I am in Vermont. And then I find out that the story was set in Vermont. And that was also an alarming aspect of the narrative.
Ken, why? I mean, when you think of it as a fictional story, but one that may have been sort of set in Vermont or inspired by the surroundings of Shirley Jackson, why, given that it's fiction, why does that right. sort of alarm you?
As fiction, it operates as a different form of reality because of the, you know, reputation that we sometimes get here now for, you know, insularity and for the question of whether we welcome outsiders and whether outsiders are indeed welcome. And, you know, my understanding of the story is, you know, revolves exactly around that point. And I think, you know, that still plays out right there in Rutland, questions about Syrians coming to Rutland. You know, these questions about, like, who belongs, really.
Ken, thanks for your thoughts. Yeah. I appreciate that. Miles, jump in. What are you thinking? Yeah.
Jump in for a minute, if I can. I know the story is written in Vermont. I don't think that Shirley Jackson ever spoke about where she imagined the story taking place. On that, she was very careful to say that it was a story. You know, it was just, A, it was just fiction, and B, that it really could be set anywhere. The second part of what Ken mentioned actually has come up a lot. A lot of people have found the story to be pertinent to the climate of what we're sort of going through now as a country in a lot of ways internationally. So I was interested. It was not particularly my intention, but I was interested to see so many people pick up on the themes of the story as being very, very much relevant to us today.
Are you finding that, Miles, that people are taking that story that was published in the 1940s and applying it to present-day politics, present-day culture, whether here or in France, and looking at it through our own
sure.
current cultural lens?
You know, if for because all you know, obviously, all sort of direct metaphors would be imperfect. However, one thing that you can certainly note about the story is that it talks about fear and what fear can do to communities and how it can sort of bend our perceptions of what we should be doing as communities or as people in general. And that, I think, is a timeless issue, whether it's now or back in 1948, what fear does as a moral, personal, or political element in our sort of public discourse is definitely something that I think the story requires us to look at and definitely encourages us to think about. So in that way, it is a very pertinent story. I think it's something we should all keep in mind.
Miles Hyman is an author and illustrator. He's the creator of the new graphic novel adaptation of his grandmother Shirley Jackson's The Lottery. His book is called Shirley Jackson's The Lottery, the authorized graphic adaptation. We've been speaking to Miles from his home in Paris, France. Miles, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you very much.
Coming up, our Halloween special continues when we peel back the curtain and turn on the lights to see what's behind Nightmare Vermont's haunted circus. This is Vermont Edition. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Running a haunted house is a complicated and labor-intensive affair at the best of times. It can be even trickier when the theme of your haunted house becomes the trigger for an unexpected nationwide freakout. Jana Beegley is the owner and founder of Nightmare Vermont, which puts on an interactive haunted house every year at the Champlain Valley Exposition. Months and months ago, Jana and the other operatives behind Nightmare Vermont decided on this year's theme, a haunted circus. You can probably see where this is going. Yes, how was Jana Beegley to know that there would be a widespread, inexplicable clown panic? here to talk about how all that worked out and about the ins and outs of haunted houses, even in non-clown panic years, is Nightmare Vermont's Jana Beegley. Jana, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Hi, Jane. I'm so happy to be here.
Can you tell me a little bit about what the Nightmare Vermont experience is like? We, happily for me, are sitting in a studio, not in a haunted circus. But if we were to be inside the haunted circus, what is this experience like?
Well, we have taken over the grandstand of the Champlain Valley Exposition. And unbeknownst to many of the people who enjoy the concerts and other events that involve the grandstand, there's a lot of hidey holes and tunnels and rundown spaces that really just need a little darkness to be very, very creepy. And so we are a theatrical haunted house. We tell an original narrative that's created from scratch every year. And so our audiences walk through the different spaces of the event. They stop and they see scenes performed by characters and stunt people that have been rehearsing for 6 weeks. And it's a completed story that you follow from beginning to end.
See, now for me, this is, I mean, I just, my whole being is saying, why would anybody intentionally want to be scared? I mean, for me, that's when I just, my body shuts down and I think, all right, close my eyes and pretend this isn't happening. Maybe just die here and not have to experience this fear. Listeners, if that is not you, I really would like to understand why people like to be scared. You can post a note on the Vermont Edition Facebook page or send us an email, vermontedition@vpr.net, or hey, give us a call, 1-800-639-2211. Jana, what is it for you? Why is this so appealing to people?
Well, there's actually a really piquant psychological reaction when people go through a frightening experience that they when they feel in control and that they have decided to go through. It's not only psychologically healthy, it makes people more resilient and it gives them a sense of empowerment within themselves, but it's also extraordinarily bonding between individuals. It's actually a lot less fun to go through a haunted house alone. Almost all of our ticket sales are in pairs. And it's a huge date night experience. People bring their significant others. And this is why people go to horror movies for dates, because when you have a scary experience with someone else, shared with someone else, it bonds people together. And it's those community bonds that we build not only amongst our audience, but also in our cast as well, because we have a lot of adventures together and share a lot of funny stories about shenanigans for putting this show on.
Any that are suitable for radio, can you share one with us?
Well, we keep a victim count. This year, we had 5 people use the safe word to get out of the show. We had 2 people pee their pants.
See, now I'd be using the safe word before I even entered. I'd be turning around at the entrance.
Well, and we do customize our experience so that you can experience Nightmare Vermont without anyone getting in your face, or you can experience it in the full contact way.
You also actually wear something on your body, right, that says it's like a ward. Is that what it's called?
They're little glow-in-the-dark necklaces, and it's just a signal to everyone in the event that this person is really only here to enjoy the suffering of others.
Right. Don't attack this person. But you can also wear one that is called a teaser, right? So that
right.
If you want to have a much more interactive experience with the performers, they will sort of target you.
Right. And we actually started this because we like all haunted houses should have anyway, we have a no-touch rule. We never make physical contact with our patrons. And we try and stick to those rules. But we did in our very first year let people know that if they had a friend in the audience and they had that kind of relationship, they could break that barrier. And we actually got complaints from our patrons who were jealous of the people who got basically carried off by zombies that year.
Uh-huh.
And then we realized there was kind of a market for people who really wanted to be part of the show. And so that's what the monster teaser does.
So then the actors, the performers will sort of bring you in and make you more of a target in this. And you said 2 people, though. I interrupted you. 5 people used the safe word. 2 people actually peed their pants this year.
Yep. 4 people lost their phones and got them returned filled with clown pictures. And I think we had 1 fainter.
Oh.
One person
Poor
just
person.
Fainted dead away.
Oh, no. So let's go here to the clown pictures, because I understand you had decided on this theme of a haunted circus with a lot of scary clowns long before this sort of national weirdness over the scary clown phenomenon started. So you didn't think about changing your theme at that point?
We did not. We were very committed to it. And it was actually, it's been a long time in the works because my co-writer has a clown phobia. And this was the first year he had a trip during the show. And so he wasn't going to be there for the show. And I said, Pat, you realize if you're not going to be there, we've got to do a circus theme. Like at some point, we've been waiting 10 years. And he reluctantly consented, refused to write any of the scenes with clowns in them.
So he really does have a clown phobia.
He really does.
Okay, so you decided to keep doing this clown and circus theme, but then we had these, as I said, sort of weirdness with people dressing up as scary clowns and in some cases making what appeared to be some real threats and scaring people who did not invite themselves to be scared. And I understand that for you, while you didn't change the theme, you did actually have to sort of hire more security or get more security in for Nightmare Vermont this year to actually protect your clowns.
Well, we are always careful about our audiences are sometimes rowdy. They're frightened. They're having visceral reactions. And we always want everyone to stay safe. And so we train our actors to be aware of body language, to be aware of their physical positioning. And this year we really added to some of our safety training the fact that we might get people who had particular visceral reactions to clowns. And we might also get people who might try to join our ranks or prank our audience. And we really wanted to make sure that we stayed in control of the experience that our audience paid for and consented to. Because that's a huge part of why we do what we do and what we believe in about what we do. That this is something that people can feel in control of, that they know what they're getting into, and that we deliver on what we say we're going to provide for people. And we want people to continue to feel safe coming to our haunted house, trying out a scary experience. And we really feel strongly that it's not okay to prank people or scare people in a way that they did not consent to.
I'm talking with Jana Beegley. She's the owner and founder of Nightmare Vermont, which puts on these interactive haunted houses every year. And actually, it's over now, even though today is Halloween. You can't go to Nightmare Vermont tonight. Why don't you do it on Halloween, too?
We have. Nightmare goes the last two weekends, Thursday through Saturday of October. Mm. And I think for 2013, and I think either the year before or the year after that, we did end up doing a show on Halloween. And it's kind of we wonder whether or not people will come out, but mm-hmm. we've always managed to sell out pretty consistently, especially on Saturdays. Yeah, I'm actually really excited because Halloween falls on a Monday. I don't have a show and I can finally go trick-or-treating with my son.
Are you dressing up?
I will possibly. My son is dressing as the Grim Reaper. I will possibly be a ghost if he wishes, but I don't want to embarrass him.
All right, so it's his choice. You
yes.
might just be mom.
Again, the consent thing. It's important.
What does it actually take to put together something like Nightmare Vermont? Because, you know, as you mentioned, there are a lot of hidey holes in the Champlain Valley Exposition Grandstand that all it takes is a little darkness to and a little bit of suggestion to make people scared. But there must also be a lot of work and a lot of performance because this is sort of theater mixed with horror.
Yes, it is a full theatrical production, and we're in a space that was not designed to be a haunted house, you know, let alone a theatrical haunted house. So like the story and like the rehearsals for our actors, everything starts from scratch. And we build it from the ground up. We decorate it from the ground up. We pull everything out of a storage container. We pull everything out of my basement. And it's actually a pretty enormous effort. You ask what it takes to put this on, and my answer is a little bit of obsessive passion because no one in their right mind would do this.
You said it, not me. So how far in advance are you thinking? I mean, have you already figured out next year's theme and you're starting to work on some of the ideas, at least, for next year's Haunted Vermont?
There have been discussions.
Nightmare Vermont.
And And we also have our children's show, our sister show, Spookyville, which is for kids. And it actually has also a no tears, no scares matinee for even tiny children. Because one of the things that we really feel passionately about is we're making the next generation of Halloween lovers. And so we really want this to be an enjoyable Halloween for every single age group.
Have you always been a Halloween lover?
Just about, yeah. Last year was my 25th anniversary as a haunter. I've been doing this for 25 years.
So do you try to find times to scare yourself not on Halloween as well?
I do watch horror movies. I watch all the horror movies just for research. I don't enjoy them all. There's a lot of bad horror movies out there. But I go to haunted event conventions. I go to other people's haunted houses. I feel bad sometimes because I've completely lost my startle reflex. So it's actually really difficult to make me jump, but I really appreciate a well-crafted scare.
That's Jana Beegley. She's the owner and founder of Nightmare Vermont, which if you are now intrigued, you'll have to wait until next year to be a part of or to experience. Jana, thank you so much for telling us about it. Really appreciate it. Happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween to you too, Jane.
And that does it for today's show. If you liked our show today, check out VPR's great podcast, Brave Little State. Their latest episode is a compendium of Vermont ghost stories. You can listen at bravelittlestate.org. Tomorrow, the first of three debates this week, we'll hear from the candidates for Lieutenant Governor, Republican Randy Brock, and Progressive Democrat David Zuckerman. They'll present their positions and explain why they want your vote. You can still submit a question for the debate by emailing vermontedition@vpr.net. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Sinscary, Sinister Sam Gale Rosen, and Monstrous Meg Malone. Mary Killiams directed the program, and our executive producer is Patty Daniels, who is literally a cannibal. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this broadcast is coming from inside your house. Thanks for listening.